I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The title of the book evokes my next guest's most famous iconic role in television, that of the cigarette-smoking man or cancer man on The X-Files. It's the role he's well known for better and worse. The book, however, is more than just a dishy memoir of his years on the science fiction series. It was initially shot here in Vancouver. The book discusses the life of William B. Davis from his upbringing in Ontario to the development of Canadian theater in the 1950s and 60s, his time in the British theater, encountering people like Laurence Olivier and Albert Finney, to his time back in Canada, working in Toronto and here in Vancouver, up to his role on The X-Files. It's a compelling read, as he's candid about himself, and he's insightful about his craft, acting in television and in the theater. He's perhaps too honest when it comes to a discussion of his personal life, his sex life especially, but one wonders what his lovers think. It's a fascinating and most enjoyable read. The book is called Where There's Smoke, Musings of a Cigarette-Smoking Man. It's published by ECW Press. The website for more is at williambdavis.com. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, William Davis. Good morning, Mr. Davis.
Good morning. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah.
I enjoyed the book a great deal, but people will pick up the book or they'll read the book because of The X-Files and the connection to the show. I never got into the show. I never watched the show, so I was interested in the rest of your life, I guess.
Good.
Yeah, but you do realize, though, that The X-Files will likely be in the first or second line of your obituary. Is that something that you'd made peace with right after the show became a huge success?
It's extraordinary, and it's interesting that you mention the obituary, because just a week or two ago, John Neville died, and he had a significant role on The X-Files, and the publicity was all about X-File actor John Neville has mm-hmm. died. John Neville was the artistic director of the Stratford Festival. He was one of the most prominent British actors in the 60s and the 70s, and had a stellar career that had nothing to do with X-Files, but his relatively minor role on X-Files has just whitewashed the rest of his career. So yes, we have to come to terms with where fame takes us, and it's taken me some wonderful places, so I've come to terms with that. Yes, absolutely.
So let's start at the very beginning. You were born, was it in Toronto? Or?
Yes, actually in Toronto, yes.
Yeah. So what kind of childhood was that like?
Well, it's so interesting, and that there's so few of us around now to kind of share that experience of what the 1940s even and the early 50s was like as a child, because it was in many ways just so different from what we have now. I mean, we had horses pulling bread wagons. We had what we called prep schools. Well, they were public schools, but they were called prep. And we always had the Lord's Prayer, and we always sang God Save the King. And it was quite a stable environment, and very unlike, I think, what current generations have now, especially with electronic media and so on. I mean, we didn't even have television. We had radio, which I listened to endlessly as a child, but we didn't have television until I was a teenager.
And I guess the prep school experience that helped you when you moved to England, right?
Well, actually, you know, not really, because that's just a term. What we meant by prep school was not what the British mean by prep school. So.
Like boarding school,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, right.
Are you still into horses?
It's a funny question you should ask. Yes, I had horses when I was in high school, and gradually I had to sell them because I didn't have time to look after them. And horses disappeared from my life until about a year and a half ago, when I met my lovely Emmanuel, whom I have since married, and whom my biggest rival is her horse. She's an equestrian, and a very accomplished equestrian, so I have renewed my acquaintance at least with her horse, but there was a long gap in my horse life.
And so do you go to races in the sort still, or...?
No. Well, actually, I shouldn't say that. I've been a couple of times with my brother, who actually has become a horse owner, and he has horses at Woodbine Racetrack. And so I've been a couple of times to a very different horse experience from when I was a child, going to the, when I used to, well, I shouldn't say as a child, but as a young man, and I used to go to races at the old Woodbine, and now, of course, he goes to the fancy club, and one is served meals, and one watches from inside, and one watches mostly on a TV screen. It's a very different experience from what I remember.
You talked about what a different time it was when you were growing up. I guess the title of the book refers to smoking and cigarettes. People smoked back then.
Oh, my goodness, did they ever smoke? I mean, it was very strange to... The people who didn't smoke were generally thought of as wimps. They were there was something a little bit odd about them. They just weren't part of the group. I remember starting to smoke. We would crawl under the bridge. There was a bridge near where we lived with a stolen package of cigarettes, and we would puff away when I was, I don't know, 12 or something, I suppose. Finally, my mother found out that I was smoking, so she made a rule that we couldn't smoke until we earned our own living and could smoke earned our own money and could smoke cigarettes that we ourselves paid for. But I fooled her because I became a child actor and I started to earn money on the radio, and so I could afford to smoke. So I bought cigarettes and I lit one up in the living room, and she said, "No, what are you doing? What are you doing? You can't smoke." I said, "You said I could smoke if I earned my own living, if I earned my own money." No, you can't smoke until you're 16, she said. Oh, okay. So when I turned 16, of course, I was no longer a radio actor, because my voice had broken. So I lit up a cigarette again, and she said, No, you can't do that. You can't smoke until you can earn your own money to pay for your own cigarettes. So it was a shifting goalpost to try to keep me from smoking. But my parents smoked like chimneys, so it was hard.
There's a great story in the book about how you held the cigarette on the television show, and unknowingly it was because of... You saw your father do it, I guess, in a photograph, right?
Exactly, yeah. What became the sort of trademark of how my character smoked, how he held his cigarette, and it just seemed a natural way for me to do it, and it wasn't the usual way people smoke. It wasn't until I was doing research for the book and I came across a picture of my father as a younger man smoking and holding his cigarette in exactly the same way. So and that picture's in the book.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned you were a child actor on radio. As you got older, You did more directing than acting, I guess. Is that right?
Yes. When I was at university, which I started thinking primarily as an actor, this is really what I wanted to do, but I had some opportunities to direct, grabbed one, and it just sort of took off. I just became what I really knew I could do and what people thought I could do and valued me for doing. For 20 years or so, that was primarily what I did, directing in the theater in Canada and in Britain and then back in Canada, and kind of as an offshoot of that, teaching acting as well.
Is there a difference in terms of acting, say, in this country as opposed to that in England or in America, in the way it's taught, maybe?
Yes, there are definitely differences, and some of the differences are geographical and some are generational, so it's hard to say kind of which is which. But when I went to theater school in England, which was kind of the model for Canada at the time, it was kind of like if you want to really do it in this world of the theater or of acting or of the profession, you have to go to England. Of course, now you have to go to Los Angeles or maybe New York, but at that time it was London. And I trained in London, and it was very good training, but mysteriously they didn't teach you how to act. We did a lot of voice, a lot of movement, and a lot of acting. We worked in a lot of plays, and we were directed and coached and blah, 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 blah. But we weren't actually taught how to act. We weren't given lessons in acting. Whereas in the U.S., that's the common practice and has been since Meisner and Strasberg and all those guys teach classes in acting, and you watch when you go to class, and you watch people learn to act, which I've done, and actually it works rather well, but in some ways it seems a little strange, because you wouldn't go to watch hockey players, you wouldn't watch two hockey players skating up and down and watch them and then watch the coach give them lessons and then learn about playing hockey by watching the hockey players learn about, you would do it. Mm-hmm. You would just do it. So, but there's a balance. You can certainly learn some techniques that way. But acting in Britain and at the time and in Canada was more theater-focused than in the U.S. and more about range of performance, being able to perform different roles and be able to extend, whereas an awful lot of film acting is about bringing yourself truthfully to the role, but not necessarily expanding your range.
Now, you tell the story in the book about Olivier and Dustin Hoffman filming a scene in Marathon Man.
Right.
And there's a scene, I guess, one second, let me clear my throat. There's a scene where Hoffman has to appear as though he had just jogged or ran or something like that.
Right.
And so he to get to prepare for the scene, he actually runs around the block or whatever the case may be. And then Olivier says to him, "Why don't you just act as though you?"
Exactly.
And which of the two do you subscribe to? Or?
Well, you know, it's a balance.
Yeah.
I mean, I think what happened at that time, as I understood the story, is, you know, because they had to do several takes, he had to keep doing it and doing it and doing it, and he was getting exhausted,
yeah.
At which point Olivier said, "Oh, dear boy, why don't you try acting?" And there's truth in both. As an actor, what we are trying to do is live truthfully in imagined circumstances. And so you can imagine that you've run around the block two or three times. You don't actually have to do it. I mean, if you had to do it, then how would you play Macbeth? You would have to kill a king every night. We have to be able to imagine these circumstances. On the other hand, you know, to generate the physical state of the character, why not? Obviously, there are things some film actors do that I wouldn't dream of. You couldn't pay me $1 million to add 30 or 40 pounds for a film role. I just... my health is more important than $1 million, but, you know, they do it.
Now, in the book, you're also quite candid about yourself, about the relationships that you've had with various women, about sex. I wonder how the women in the book reacted to how they're depicted.
Yes, you mentioned that in your introduction, and I thought, oh, dear. It's interesting, because as I was doing the book, I really wasn't saying too much about those things, and my partner at the time kept saying, the women aren't present. What about the women in your life? And reminding me that the readers of memoirs are primarily women, so I understand. And of course, they, you know, I don't want to say women like those things and men don't, but personal details are fascinating to people. You suggest maybe I said too much. Maybe I did. Not just about the women, but about some of my professional colleagues as well. As I tried to be candid in the book, I tried to be honest in the book, and I tried to make it a good story. So I haven't heard negatives from the women yet, but I may, and there was certainly one or two cases where I wasn't sure how they'd react, and so we talked. Actually, in one case, called a person and said, "What do you think if I put this in my book?" And she said, no, please don't. So I put it in the book, but didn't put her name in the book, and I don't think she's in any way identifiable, because it was too good a story not to put in. But it's a good question. It's a good question.
In the book, you talk about your divorce from Francine. And, you know, you're quite candid about what happened and the sort. And, you know, you talk about what you were feeling and what you were thinking at the time. And it just, it made me wonder what she thought and whether she agreed. And, you know, it's... I don't know. I don't want to judge what she... I doubt that you she'd agree with your assessment of the situation.
No, and I hope I made that clear. I certainly did say that in the book, but, you know, certain things aren't always remembered, because I do say in the book, I'm sure Francine has a very different picture of these events. But yes, that may not be what stands out when and if she should read the book. I have sent the copies of the book to our children who have not yet read it, and I'm not sure if they will or what they will think when they do. But
you have a good relationship with your children now?
I do. It's been a bit strained for geographical reasons, because Rebecca is now spending quite a bit of time in war-torn countries developing dance projects with orphans of war. So she's pretty unavailable a lot of the time, and Melinda's been very, very, very busy with her family and her job. She's just finally becoming officially an official cardiologist, and lives in Michigan, and I live in Vancouver. So there are these limitations, but the relationship is very good, I think.
Now, you've recently remarried, my understanding is?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So do you live in Vancouver full-time, or?
I'm splitting my time somewhat between Vancouver and France, which is where she lives, and she's splitting her time between France and Vancouver. Of course, we spend a fair bit of time apart as well. But she is the financial manager of the city of Hyères in the south of France. A very good job, and her career is moving extremely well. Mine is more flexible. Fortunately, Europeans have pretty good holidays, so we work it out pretty well. The south of France is a pretty nice place to go. So
I would think, yeah.
Yeah.
In the book, you describe yourself as an oversexed senior. Do you ever wonder what you could have accomplished with celibacy?
No, I don't. And it's funny that little remark about being an oversexed senior, because I remember I wrote that long before I met my new wife. I know it was in the context of having to kiss young women when I was a young man, having to kiss them on stage and finding it an uncomfortable thing to do, and wondering, why did I find that uncomfortable? Give me a chance to do that now. I don't know if I'm really an oversex senior, but it sounded good at the time.
Yeah. Now, the X-Files, inevitably we have to talk about that, because that's what why people will pick up the book, unfortunately, because there's some great stories in here. I mean, the stuff that you talk about in terms of the development of theater in this country is just, I mean, it's almost textbook, necessary reading about what happened in this country in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Before we get to the X-Files, let's talk about that. Those were heady days, weren't they?
They were, absolutely. Because Canada was just sort of blossoming. I mean, well, to start with, the whole radio time was amazing in the kind of early 50s, just how much radio drama there was. It was huge. I mean, there was radio dramas daily, and quite a number of actors were making very good livings, and it was an ongoing concern. And television supplanted that, of course, but then the television in its early days in Canada was devoted to doing a lot of theater, a lot of plays, a lot of classics, a lot of serious work, and gradually it's become Americanized, and all that's changed quite a lot. And then subsequent to that, of course, the Canadian writers and Canadian theaters began to blossom in the late 60s, early 70s. There was a lot of money being spent, a lot of grants to different projects, theater companies starting in Toronto and Vancouver, and it was exactly a heady time. Everything seemed possible at the time.
I began the last question with the X-Files, and we digressed dramatically into that. But when you got the job, I guess that was in the pilot, right?
Right, yeah.
Did you think that it was going to be the success that it became?
I don't think any of us thought it would be such a success when we were working on it. There was no kind of feeling, oh, gosh, here we are on the edge of something amazing. It was more, oh, well, this is an interesting gig. I wonder how it'll do, and blah, 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 blah. But there was no kind of, at least not in the world I was inhabiting. It might have been different for David and Jillian, but there was no sense that we were on the edge of something. In fact, for me, I didn't think of it beyond what I was doing, because at the time I was running my acting school, and I was really acting to kind of fill out my part of my pocketbook, but also my experience, so that it helps me with my teaching. And this role was a non-speaking role in a series about alien abductions, which seemed highly unlikely to be successful. And if it was, would it shoot in Vancouver if it did get picked up? And if it did get picked up and shot in Vancouver, would my character ever reappear? All of these seemed fairly unlikely, and so I thought no more about it after I did the pilot.
And I mean, it became such a big success. Are there conventions to this day? Do you go to those?
Yes, there are no longer strictly X-File conventions, which there used to be during the life of the series. But there are science fiction conventions, or media conventions of various kinds, all the time. I don't go to a lot, but I do go to some. I just did two in France. I did one in Paris and one in Toulouse. Convenient, because of course I was half living in France, so it was easy to do that. Yeah. And I'm doing one in Burbank in February. And people line up to buy your picture, and it still has an ongoing life.
People are obviously interested in what David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson were like. In the book, we get a sense of what working with them was like. It didn't get personal at all, did it? Like, you didn't get to know them very well.
No, I did not. I don't know quite why. Sometimes I wished I had with David, and I think probably the opportunity was there, and we were probably both a little shy. Gillian is generally pretty reclusive. I don't know if reclusive is quite the right word, but certainly moving in her own world. So there was never any real opportunity to get to know her well. We had a few moments of good feeling together, but on the whole, it was fairly distant. They kept their distance, and in a way that's not always the case when I've worked with, I've worked with Martin Sheen, and I've worked with a lot of John Neville, of course, and really successful actors, and found them much easier to relate to and to connect with. David and Gillian, they both had their own kind of separate world that they lived in, and in a funny way, I think that brought something quite unique to the show, that those personality characteristics in some way projected into the show and gave them some of their mystery and some of their dynamism that, I tell a story in the book about working with Anne Hathaway, mm-hmm. and, she's become a big star, and she was a pretty big star when we worked, and I was only had a small part on this film, and I'd been away from the film for a couple of weeks, and I came back, and she said, how are you? How's it been going? What's been happening with you? Ever so friendly. And I thought, in 9 years of working with Gillian Anderson, she never once asked me, how are you? How's it going, Bill? But Anne Hathaway's a different kind of person, and she might not have been the right person to play to play Scully on The X-Files, and Julian clearly was. So.
Now, you're an acting teacher. Did you look at their acting, say, differently than if you weren't working with them?
I'm sure I do. Yes, I'm sure. I'm sure I always do that. I mean, I always look at actors and how they are acting, sometimes even during scenes when I was kind of this silent person in the background and I need to be thinking about something, I was probably thinking about how are they acting? How are they doing this work? Yes, I'm sure I watch their acting rather more closely than I would. Than another actor might, just because that's what I do. I mean, I do that when I see any film or any play. It's like a musician, I think. And when I hear a false note in acting, it's like a musician hearing a false note in an orchestra or in a symphony that I would never hear because I'm not a musician. But
I guess what I'm trying to do is ask you how they are as actors, and if you had an assessment. Yeah.
I can honestly say I think they're both terrific actors.
And better at the end of the series than they were at the beginning?
Jillian was definitely better at the end of the series than at the beginning. I mean, she just grew and grew and grew. I talked about in the book this one episode that we did on the Queen Mary, and in about four takes, and she's just amazing in that episode. David was always good. David was much better at the beginning. When I say he's much better at the beginning, I don't mean he got worse. He brought a natural ease at the beginning of the work, which I think was very important. Whether he grew as much as Jillian, I'm not sure. I wouldn't really say. He was a little up and down. I mean, how he felt on a given day could make a difference to what he brought to the set.
And when the show, I mean, there was a big deal in this town when the show moved to Los Angeles. You were part of the move as well?
Yeah, what happened was, I didn't have to actually physically move. I just had to go to Los Angeles whenever they needed me. So it did certainly change my life in that sense. But I was never in a lot of episodes in a given season. But it did mean that I had some frequent trips to Los Angeles and worked in Los Angeles, which was actually good for me because I never really had moved in that world or got to know people in that world. So that was fascinating for me to have that opportunity, which I wouldn't have had if the show had stayed here.
What's the state of the acting scene in Vancouver? I'm talking about the acting that we see on stage at the various theater companies, as well as the sort of work in film and television. I mean, is it as good as it was when The X-Files was in this town?
I think so. I think so. There's not as much work in film and television as there was, maybe even 5 or 6 years ago, and that's been a challenge for the working actor here. But I just directed a production of Hay Fever for the United Players, which is a community theater. So the actors have to be officially amateur and not members of either of the acting unions. And we had an amazing cast of very well-trained young actors who are extremely talented, extremely well-trained, and extremely good, and should be earning a lot more money than they were earning from the United Players. But that's a bit the way the business is right now in Vancouver.
So looking back at the career that you've had, the good and the bad of it, are there regrets? I mean, do you wish you'd done that movie with Albert Finney?
Oh, that's such a question. Certainly later in my life, I wished I'd done the movie with Albert Finney. He had asked me to be his assistant on the first movie he directed. This was back in the 60s, and at that time, I was only sort of interested in cinema. I was really a theater artist and blah, 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 blah. But, 20 or or more years later when I started to direct some film myself and get it, I thought, wow, if I'd had that experience, if I'd opened up that part of my life then, would that be interesting? But probably then I would have stayed in Britain. I would never have come back to Canada. I would never have been an acting teacher. I certainly would never have been in the X-Files. And who knows if I'd be a successful film director now or just an out-of-work actor and director in England. Who knows?
Yeah. And so you're not retired. You're obviously directing still. Do you still act?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In January, I'm going to shoot a fairly low-budget science fiction feature film that, for various reasons, is going to shoot in the Bahamas. So I'm going down there for a week in January to shoot that. And I plan to direct for the graduating project for the graduating class from the William Davis Center, my old school, in the spring. So, yeah, I'm keeping going.
Mm-hmm. The school is not where, I mean, I remember it, what was it, Helmken and Hornby, right?
Yeah, where there's a big hole in the ground.
Yeah. So where is the school now? Is it
The school was actually bought by Van Arts, which is a larger school, a media school in downtown Vancouver. And so the William Davis Center is now a section of that school. It's still called the William Davis Center. It's the William Davis Center for Actors Study at Van Arts. And it's actually doing really, really well right now. It's the training is excellent. They're getting very good students. It's run by Chilton Crane, and it's doing excellently.
And do you teach there regularly, or how does that work?
Not regularly, because my schedule hasn't really allowed me to do that. But bits and pieces from time to time, when we can work it in, they're always glad to have me, and I'm always glad to do it when we can.
Bill, it's been delightful to talk today, and as I said off the top, I really enjoyed the book. It's just a great read. Congratulations on it. Continued good luck with it.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. The website, williambdavis.com. The book is called Where There's Smoke, Musings of a Cigarette-Smoking Man. It's from ECW Press. It's a candid, thoughtful memoir about Mr. Davis's career, acting, and a history of the theater in this country and more. It's a compelling read. William B. Davis on the line in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.